We have a story idea. We have characters with a problem to solve. We have angst and betrayal, complications and twist. How do we build that into a novel? Maybe this episode can help. Time for one guiding decision. Plot it. Welcome to The Right Focus, a podcast for writers at all levels, headed up by M.A. Lee with the assistance of Eddie Wounds and Remy Black, all from Writers, Inc. Books. Our focus is productivity, process, craft, and tools. A summary, links, resources for this and other episodes can be found at therightfocus.blogspot.com. Write to us at linkbooks@aol.com. Our podcasts last as long as it takes to fix a quick dinner, drive a short commute, or take a brisk walk. We're bookcasting with Think Like a Pro by M.A. Lee, copyright 2017 and revised 2018. This episode covers the beginning of Chapter 3, One Guiding Decision, Plot It. Here we go. White hot writing, not worrying about plot or characters, just letting the story flow. Now that is fun. At some point, however, that flashover of creativity burns out. We know all those chaotic thoughts need order to turn into a story. That ordered structure, event to event to event, is plot. As a writer staring at the chaos, a story without form and void, our guiding decision is to select the right plot for our story. Plot is the foundation of all story. It builds story. The key to any construction job is the foundation. People buy houses based on the square footage they need and the look of the life they want. The buyers don't consider the state of the foundation. That's the job of the builder. And the foundation is buried in the ground, unseen, doing its job without any acclaim or gratitude or blessing. Without a strong foundation, however, the whole structure would fall apart. So it goes with story. People may love the characters and chatter excitedly about events and the genre tropes, but everything in that story will fall apart if the foundation is not solid. Should storytellers neglect plot, the story suffers, and not even the most wonderful characters and stupendous events and twisty tropes can rescue it. So I say it again, plot is the foundation of story. While we writers may begin with a white-hot what-if scenario or a character we're burning to explore, we must admit, and admit it early in our creative process, that we need a foundation to reveal the hearts and souls of our characters. Without a solid foundation, no one will buy our house or a story. What happens if we want to build avant-garde? Well, I have a particular love of modern houses and furniture designs. I like non-traditional for its very difference, the new view of exteriors and living spaces, the juxtaposed twist on forms, the clever use of old materials in new ways, the strong shake that the modern gives to the idea of home. Yet even Frank Lloyd Wright's Falling Waters depended on a strong foundation. Experimental poetry like Lawrence Ferlinghetti's Constantly Risking Absurdity and E.E. Cummings' But and David Bottom's The Sun may seem edgy and new. Avant-garde, as challenging as they are to read, experimental poems still depend upon certain foundational elements of the poetry genre. Modern writers, even the absurdist, still manage to use foundations for their text. Their plays and stories are as much negative mirrors of a type of plot as they are anything. Even though it may seek to avoid, the most avant-garde text still reveals its foundation. Tilt your head a little sideways and think metaphor. See it yet? Like a painter manipulating negative space, the image is still revealed. Here's conundrum one. Absence is negative space, which is revelatory to the presence. What's in front of us, the presence, may look gone, absent, but it still remains, waiting to be seen and understood. The frustrations that most readers and viewers have with some stories and films are their lack of a strong foundation. They never quite reach a destination, or they go everywhere as they're getting there. People may claim a love of edgy chaos, but they don't, not really. Just leave a story without its foundational climax and hear the wails. Frank Stockton's The Lady or the Tiger, anyone? Here's conundrum two. The role of any writing is to communicate. If you're not communicating, are you writing or scrambling words? Avant-garde literature may attempt to avoid plot, but a close examination reveals the foundation. Sometimes a mishmash that leaves no one happy except the artist who think he's or she's being modern. Let me dispel a couple of myths. First, nothing is new. Avant-garde is not even new. And should such works somehow endure for centuries, they are merely studied as the oddities that they are, while writers like Shakespeare continue to entertain and enlighten us. Take the most modern work we can find, apply a basic plot type, and we discover much. Once we see the foundation, we discover that it's not as new and edgy as we originally thought. Writers who cry, "My story's different, my story's new, my story's unique," can expect this shock. It's not new, different, unique. I do regret offending those writers, but the truth has thorns. In all the millennia that people have told stories, all the possible combinations have already occurred. Nothing's new under the sun. That's a quote from Ecclesiastes 1:9. How do we build plot? When I first encountered Booker's 7 types of plot, without any context, I assumed the Booker Prize people presented it. I was wrong. Very, very wrong. We know what happens when people assume. I also should have known better. But I was crediting the Booker Prize people with more sense, I guess. In his 2004 book, The 7 Basic Plots, Why We Tell Stories, influenced by Carl Jung, Christopher Booker returns to the roots of the story. Okay, here's a caveat. People have taken me to task about even looking sideways at Christopher Booker. Among other crimes, he's very old-fashioned with his views about women's places in society. Well, my grandfather's had very old-fashioned views. Times change. Some people change with the enlightenment that comes with time. Some people don't. I do have a discussion later in the book about those people who don't want to change. The point, I won't ignore Booker's literary insights just because I don't agree with his social commentary. So, no matter what kind of fiction you write, and this works for even much of the nonfiction realm, the foundational structure will fit one of 7 types of plot. Booker has staked a powerful claim. How can it be that for all the stories in the world, from the most ancient myth to the most disaffected, absurdist modern, only 7 plots exist? If that claim is true, it will work across all times and all genres. Let's test it. Type 1, Overcoming the Monster, Beowulf. Yeah. Jaws, Lord of the Flies, that's definitely about overcoming the monster. King Lear, Alien, Pride and Prejudice. We might have to look at the monster as a little bit metaphorical. Fried Green Tomatoes, Atonement. Yep, those fit. Let's try Rags to Riches, Cinderella, Aladdin, Oliver Twist, Great Gatsby. Wow, Prince and the Pauper, Good Deeds, Pretty Woman. All those fit. The Quest Story, Watership Down, Raising Arizona, Willow, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Avatar, The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, Northanger Abbey. Those fit. Comedy. Anything by Aristophanes matches anything by the Marx Brothers. Airplane. The Blues Brothers. Animal House. A Walk in the Woods. Arsenic and Old Lace. Bringing Up Baby. Much Ado About Nothing. A Midsummer Night's Dream. Those all fit. Tragedy. Oedipus. Macbeth. Rebel Without a Cause. Francis. Philadelphia. Cool Hand Luke. Bonnie and Clyde. Whatever Happened to Baby Jane. Those are all tragedies. Rebirth stories include Sleeping Beauty. Beauty and the Beast. A Christmas Carol, Now Voyager, Summertime, yep, Avatar, definitely, Persuasion, yep, Under the Tuscan Sun, well, exactly, Voyage and Return, Peter Rabbit, The Hobbit, Odyssey, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, Brideshead Revisited, Mansfield Park, Great Expectations, The Tempest, what do you know? Christopher Booker is right. Whether concrete or abstract, real or metaphorical, all sorts of stories do fit these 7 categories. Here is Overcoming the Monster. This category is not as simple as it seems. We often have difficulty overcoming monsters in our daily lives. The monsters are not as easily identified as they are in the movies. We must identify the scarring and scaring evil with blood-stained claws, be it a vampire or merely a life-sucking job, a philandering spouse, or an oppressive dictator. All are monsters who destroy other people's lives. The invidious monsters are the ones who seem friendly, the ones who seem to help our protagonist, the ones who would never, not in a million years, do anything to hurt anyone. To write more than basic genre, first, you have your protagonist struggle to identify the real monster. We have to acquire the tools needed to defeat the monster. Buffy had a training schedule to become a vampire slayer. Our protagonist must train as well. If that monster is a life-sucking boss, How can the protagonist reset the boundaries between job and life? How will the philandering spouse be discovered? What will enlighten the protagonist to the invidious monsters who present themselves as friends? How will the now aware protagonist develop the skills necessary to step up and stand against the seemingly innocent monster? The actual battle often requires the sacrifice of something dear, with no guarantee that anything will ever replace our sacrifice. How does that work with Atonement? By Ian McEwan. First, we figure out who is the protagonist in the novel. It's the young girl, not the older sister. We have identified the wrong monster, which is not revealed for many years. Her misidentification sends the sister's love interest to prison and destroys the relationship between the sisters. Discovering the true monster, the pedophile who marries his victim, takes years. The tragedy of this novel is not just the doomed love. It continues to the end of the protagonist's life as she admits that she will never get atonement for her early mistake. Rags to Riches. In badly written rags-to-riches stories, logic is tossed out as writers drag the protagonist into the luxurious wealth that they think is deserved. In well-written stories, the protagonist is shown developing the skills necessary to gain wealth and succeed in that new environment. Logic tells us that no one receives something great for nothing. If you think that, by the way, I have a bridge in Brooklyn that I'd like to sell you. The impoverished state needs to be presented along with the dream of greatness that the protagonist has. That dream should be possible, not improbable. The steps from rags to riches are presented. What will each step entail? Who or what is essential to gain the skills that are the part of each step? Who or what will block the step? The wealth needs to be reasonable. Not everyone is descended from royalty or nobility, you know. Some of us were dirt farmers eager to escape our serfdom. Not everyone will walk into a top editor position just because of an association with a mysterious billionaire. By the way, what is wealth? Money or time? Knowledge? Relationships? When no money is ever obtained, but relationships are deepened, that is an example of the best riches in the world. I'm preaching. Sorry, not. Cinderella is the classic fairy tale. In rags, scrubbing the sooty hearth, she once was the privileged daughter of a wealthy noblewoman. See, she already comes with the knowledge of the etiquette and behavior necessary for a life as a queen. She was cast into her impoverished position by her father's death and her stepmother's evil. Her stepmother's stepsisters seemingly conspired to prevent her return to her former status if she wins the prince's lottery. That's a random pick, you know. Thankfully, she has helpful birds and mice and an extremely helpful fairy godmother who wants to restore balance to this little community. Don't forget the pumpkin. While her path still has problems, Cinderella does manage to return to the life into which she was born. See, that's logical. The quest story. Searching for treasure, tangible or intangible, requires a long journey to distant places in order to achieve a goal. Whether that is a physical journey, encountering exotic people for material treasure, or an intellectual journey, encountering exotic ideas for spiritual treasure. The three elements for the quest story require: remove the protagonist from the settled day-to-day existence as the first required step. The writer must present that mundane existence, showing the protagonist contrasting satisfaction and dissatisfaction. An impelling event must drive the protagonist into the quest. What is the protagonist's quest? What makes the treasure so necessary to be obtained? The protagonist will be uncomfortable and awkward as they launch into the quest. However, the dissatisfaction is strong enough that remaining in the status quo is not an option. Second, we exhibit the entrance to the place completely new. Know our story's definition of exotic. How is this new place exotic? Are different from what the protagonist has known before? How are people in this new place also part of the exotic experience for the protagonist? What is charming about the exotic experience? What remains unsatisfactory, preventing the new place from becoming a paradise? Third, discovery of the treasure is like an epiphany, whether it's the pot at the end of the rainbow that the protagonist finds and uses to improve life back home, or the discovery of something richer than was ever anticipated. How is that treasure discovered? Is it at first mistakenly avoided or ignored? If so, what brings the protagonist's attention back to it? How is the treasure a great richness? Does the treasure create such a temptation that return to the ordinary world is no longer a requirement? In Northanger Abbey by Jane Austen, our protagonist loves her family and life there, but she wants to experience a daring and racy world. A trip to Bath offers her the opportunity to experience the Tons' social world and a dash of romance from two different suitors, along with a spark or two of danger. The invitation to Northanger Abbey provides her with a suitably mysterious atmosphere that she mistakenly tries to turn into a dark mystery. The suitor that she cares about is deeply disappointed by her childish imaginings. When she is banished, she rises to an adult's responsibility and recognition of her mistakes. Her reward comes when her beloved suitor tracks her down, giving her the sacrifice that true love will willingly make to achieve the treasure it most wants. This change, marriage to her beloved, the treasure that the protagonist wanted, prevents Northanger Abbey from being a plot of voyage and return, which is our next plot type. The voyage and return seems very similar to the quest, except the goal is the return back to the original existence. A wiser person through the experienced trials and ordeals of the journey. Normal existence for the protagonist must be presented as exactly what is wanted. The reason for the journey should be dire. Destruction of that existence is threatened. The voyage itself may not be exotic. It may even seem ordinary on the surface, but it is enriching. It may simply be getting back home, older, but not necessarily wiser. Many different kinds of events will occur on this voyage. Great internal transformation will not occur. The goal of this voyage is not a treasure. The goal may not even be specified. If it is specified, then the goal will have much to do with returning home. Returning home may have obstacles, as events and people may have conspired to work against the protagonist's easy settling back into the life that they love. Thus, the return may be the point of greatest difficulty for the protagonist. However, when all problems are overcome, the life that was threatened is restored, and the sun shines once again on the protagonist and what he or she holds most dear. The Hobbit by J.R.R. Tolkien is an example of quest and return. Bilbo Baggins doesn't really want to go on a dangerous adventure with complete strangers and dwarves of all people, but he finds himself lured by Gandalf the Wizard. There's a lot of walking, there's a lot of hiding, there's a lot of arguing. He encounters trolls and elves, goblins and golem, riddles and rock giants, and a dragon with fire and the dragon of gold. He returns home, experienced, but not really wiser, eager for his own cooking and his own hearth. Oh, and a dangerous ring goes with him. But that's another story. Comedy. In writing story, we distinguish between humor and comedy. Hollywood doesn't, but Hollywood's not about story. It's about making money, using the lowest common denominator possible. Usually ridicule, usually raunchiness, usually violence, always sex. Hollywood says that comedy is a show with lots of laugh. Nope, just nope. Comedy is the protagonist achieving his goal. Humor is telling jokes. I fought the misdefinition of comedy in my classroom. Christopher Booker does it with more authority. It seems simple enough to write comedy. However, I will note that in comedy, pathos, deeply emotional moments, occur quite a good bit, while tragedies are often filled with humor. The protagonist confronts adversity. That adversity is deepened through a series of confusing events. The climax clears up all confusion and grants the protagonist the original goal, which has transformed in the unexpected way. To understand more about comedy, we need to go to tragedy and look in the opposite direction. The best example of a comedy is Midsummer Night's Dream by William Shakespeare. Two young ladies are in love with two young men. One young man returns the affection, but her father is an obstacle. One young man does not return the affection of his young woman. Acceptable as a suitor by the other young lady's father, he's after the money and status that marriage to her would bring. We won't talk about Theseus' problems with Hippolyta, Oberon's problems with Titania, and Titania's problem with Bottom, okay? They do add to the confusion of the story. A midsummer night in the woods, with interference by Puck and fairies, causes all four to fall out of love and into love at cross purposes. We have funny lines and a funny altercations. The morning finds them returned to the wits. The first couple remain in love. The second couple are now in love. All is worked out to everyone's satisfaction, including the father. Here's tragedy. In comedy, all is achieved. In tragedy, all is futile. While death is not a requirement of tragedy, doom is. Writers of tragedy, to prevent unrelenting darkness, will often fill a tragedy with humor. Shakespeare is a master of keeping the audience engaged in the tragic form. Romeo and Juliet and Macbeth have several laugh-out-loud moments that relieve the ratcheting suspense. The protagonist, through his own actions, causes his own destruction. An inner flaw sets in motion a domino effect. For an inner flaw, consider one of the seven deadly sins: pride, wrath, greed, gluttony, sloth, lust, and envy. While all may seem confused to the protagonist, we can see the steps that bring him to doom. At some point, usually toward the plot center, the protagonist takes an irrevocable step. The protagonist may see the doom's approach. If he doesn't believe it, he continues forward without check. Most protagonists will act to reverse the approaching doom. How the protagonist confronts his doom is equally key. Will he run away, or will he lean into it? In the 1992 Last of the Mohicans film, the despicable, vengeance-focused Magua leans into his doom, his one redeeming moment. Bonnie and Clyde, the story by Robert Benton and David Newman, shows us disaffected misfits who find in each other a love of thrills and violence. They join with another couple, equally disaffected and dissolute. Content with their corrupted lives, they seek a thrilling and violent way to get money. They rob people, usually small stores and rural gas stations, hard-working people who were merely trying to make ends meet, and they murder anyone who corners or confronts them. As Shakespeare warned in Romeo and Juliet, violent delights lead to violent ends. Bonnie and Clyde willfully chose violence, they relished that violence, and they are brought to a violent death. Rebirth is our last plot type. Rebirth is transformation through reformation. A special branch of the rebirth story is apotheosis, when the protagonist is transformed into God. While Eat, Pray, Love is often given as an excellent example of a rebirth plot, I think better examples are Wilde and Under the Tuscan Sun. Wilde contains a physical and intellectual transformation. Under the Tuscan Sun is a three-part reformation of self. The protagonist is no longer intellectually or physically or spiritually the person she was at the beginning. For a rebirth story, a mirror to the protagonist is needed. Some starkly clear representation occurs that awakens the protagonist to a better life. The protagonist launches into an attempt to achieve that better life with flashes of insight and stumbling steps, all of which teach the protagonist how to change from who they were into who they want to become. Eventually, a new self emerges, often in a new place. Charles Dickens' A Christmas Carol is our classic example. Miserly Scrooge counts money as more important than people. He barely pays a living wage to his employees, and Dickens paints the Cratchit family in broad strokes designed to evoke our sympathy. Reminders of Scrooge's past, coupled with the threat of his future, thank you, dear ghost, change his heart. His focus transforms, shifting him away from the accumulation of material gold to accumulating lasting relationships. He becomes compassionate and generous, no longer hated, but well-loved because of his benevolence. Oh, goodness, we've ran really long for this episode at the end of the year. Next up, we give the key to using the seven plot types. Be sure to check out our blogspot at therightfocus.blogspot.com for seven examples of those plot types. Before we launch into the five methods of plotting with their assets and detriments, we give that key. Don't forget, join in next Wednesday for part two of Plot It, One Guiding Decision. Until then, ride on.